On this episode of Story 49, we're not focusing on a person, and we're also not centering our story around an event. This time, Story 49 is all about location. I'm your host, Maddie Winchester, and you're listening to part two of our journey through the past, present, and future of Pilgrim Hot Springs. If you haven't listened to part one of this episode yet, go online to knom.org and click on Story 49. In part one, we covered the early history of Pilgrim Hot Springs, as well as its time as a roadhouse and later an orphanage. In 1941, when all the orphans had come of age and there were no children left to raise, the orphanage was closed. As the house diary put simply, on July 29, 1941, all children walked to station for train to Nome. After the mission closed, the U.S. Army began using the site for troop recreation. They built a small landing strip and remained at Pilgrim until 1945. An article by Kristen Kelly in the Nome Nugget reports that after the soldiers left, the machinery they used to brew beer remained in one of the sheds. As the years passed, the Kakarik family served as caretakers for some time, and the Kongaksirugut timeline states that several renters attempted to farm at the site afterward. In 1970, the Federal Geothermal Steam Act was passed, which Aaron Lilly reported inspired the church to grant a 99-year lease on the property to Pilgrim Springs Limited, with the intention of exploring geothermal power at Pilgrim. Research into geothermal capabilities went on for many years and is still on the table today. But though articles from the 80s talked of the hopes to use the springs to supply energy to Nome and throughout the Seward Peninsula, when Lilly published his article in 1996, Pilgrim Springs Limited had made little progress, as they faced issues with a lack of demand and a lack of investors. Beyond supplying energy, there were several other plans for the hot springs during these years. According to reporter Deborah McKinney, Pilgrim Springs Limited was considering the idea of rebuilding the village of Mary's Igloo, which had been wiped out from the flu, and using Pilgrim to supply power to the new site. The area was also of interest to a group of Anchorage psychiatrists, who Kristen Kelly reported wanted to use the area as a resort clinic due to their belief that people would gain a sense of well-being from Pilgrim's electromagnetic fields. And during these years when Pilgrim Springs Limited had a lease on the property, Pilgrim also required a long-term caretaker. Louis Green Sr. first heard about Pilgrim in the 50s, and his interest was piqued, but he didn't actually make it out to the springs for the first time until 1968, and didn't start caretaking the property until the early 1970s, when he began spending summers at Pilgrim.
So anyhow, I started doing some stuff out there in 1974, boarded up windows and stuff. In 75, we had cleared a bunch of ground and planted quite a bit of stuff, a lot of potatoes and things like that.
Planting was already an integral part of the property's past and would become a central part of Louis Green Sr.'s time at Pilgrim.
And the first year planted lots didn't do too good because the ground had been in pretty tough shape. The second year we got about 12,000 pounds of potatoes. Like then, the stores in the villages, they didn't have anything like that so much. So right away, most of the village stores wanted to try them, you know. And so that made it pretty good. They could pick up potatoes and take them there and sell them because they couldn't really get fresh stuff too often. Yeah, I had chickens, goats, geese, ducks, pigs.
And in addition to raising vegetables and livestock, Louis also raised his children at the hot springs.
Yeah, all the kids grew up out there, plus a whole bunch of others here and down that would go out and visit on weekends. And so it was place. It was pretty fun for them. You know, different. They didn't have to hang around the streets.
At the time, the property was still under lease by Pilgrim Springs Limited. But rather than getting official permission to caretake, Louis said he was given the go-ahead by a former member of the corporation.
Well, one of the guys that was in that corporation, I think he had got out of it by that time, but he seen what was going on. You know, it was getting pretty ragged out. And so when I asked him about planting some potatoes, well, he just took it on his own to say go ahead. And I did. And stayed there till, you know, kept growing stuff until 1985.
Louis saw a number of changes over his years at Pilgrim, and transportation was a big part of that. From the dog teams, boats, and railroads of the past came cars, four-wheelers, and snow machines.
How did transportation change getting to and from Pilgrim over the many years you were there?
Well, we had to go by boat from Cottonwood, where the bridge is up there. And in the spring, before the snow would go away, I'd always haul gasoline out and some of the stuff I needed to have. And then by the time April and May come along, we could go by boat, mainly from May on. And then 84, they were starting to build that road in there. So we could drive partway in, and I had a track vehicle, so I used that a lot in 84 and 85.
In the mid-80s, Louis made the decision to leave Pilgrim and let other people have a chance to work the land. Several articles in the Nome Nugget mention agricultural projects, including the piece by Kristen Kelly, which discusses plans that the farmers had to sell the produce they were growing at the glue pot in Nome. Another plan to provide local produce in Nome came from a 1990 article by Maureen Sullivan, which mentioned the creation of an experimental garden at the site and the desire to sell produce in town. But though other farmers had some success at Pilgrim, they abandoned their efforts after several years, and Louis Green Sr. was quickly asked by the surrounding communities to return as caretaker.
People from Brevig and Teller and Nome kept asking me about going back out there because, you know, people could drive in and pretty wild parties going on. So in 94, I actually started out there and planted some stuff, you know, planting potatoes and different things. So I did that until the last time I planted stuff, I think, was about 2003 or 4. That's when I last planted stuff.
Were you doing other things there as well in like a caretaking capacity, you know, looking after buildings or raking out the hot tubs or anything?
Yeah, we kept the tub going, and I would take, you know, go along, and if something got kind of risky for people to be going on or something.
And in these years when Louis Green Sr. was caretaking, the Pilgrim area remained an important place for recreation and subsistence. Roy Ashenfelter has been visiting Pilgrim with his family for more than 20 years.
I'm married to Loretta. Her family has a camp out at Pilgrim River Bridge. And so every year we've been going to the hot springs because, one, there was a hot tub there, and then, two, the natural pools that exist, even without maintaining those, are still accessible, and we enjoy getting into the hot water. Outside the periphery, away from the hot springs itself, if we're down there, we're picking berries, greens, fishing for reds, chum, pink, kings, there's moose, there's a lot of different resources there that people who enjoy subsistence hunting and fishing is very accessible.
Even though he stopped planting in 2004 and left Pilgrim in 2005, Louis returned several years later to help assist with geothermal projects.
I spent a couple of summers working with the USGS people that was working out there for the University of Alaska. And that's 2012 and 2013, I think, is when they was there. And give him a hand, and then after that, they brought in a bigger drilling outfit. And when they finished their stuff, the USGS. So I hadn't spent much time out there since then.
And while Louis was helping out with geothermal projects, the ownership of Pilgrim had changed. According to Matt Ganley, the hot springs had been auctioned off several years earlier as the diocese worked to cover its debts after being sued by the victims of sexual abuse within the church.
The Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska, the diocese, had to file for bankruptcy. It was 2009 or so, and so when it went on the auction block, they had to auction their assets to pay off those debts. And so Pilgrim Hot Springs was going to be auctioned. Barron Straits Native Corporation, Gail Schubert, then asked the villages and other organizations in the region if they would be willing to contribute to pool the resources, funding, and purchase Pilgrim Hot Springs. That was accomplished. There are a number of organizations that did join in. And a limited liability company was formed, Unaatuq, U-N-A-A-T-U-Q, LLC, which is owned by Barron Straits Native Corporation, Sitmasauk Native Corporation, Norton Stone Health Corp, Kowarik Incorporated, Narizigli Native Corporation, now Council Native Corporation, and White Mountain Native Corporation.
Teller Native Corporation was originally one of the seven investors, but they have since sold their interest in Unaatuq, which Matt Ganley says is an Inupiaq word for hot springs, to Council Native Corporation. In addition to visiting Pilgrim in his personal time, Roy Ashenfelter is the president of White Mountain Native Corporation, one of the members of Unaatuq. Even though the people of White Mountain were not traditionally users of Pilgrim Hot Springs, the corporation made the decision to join Unaatuq, in part because of their connection to the Fish River Hot Springs.
When the Pilgrim Hot Springs came up for sale, a notice went out to all the village corporations in our region, and the question asked of them if they would be interested in investing or being a partner for the purchase of Pilgrim Hot Springs. And so White Mountain chose to be one of its partners. We just felt like our corporation needed to try to invest in our region. We hadn't done that quite exclusively, or we haven't done it, period, just in White Mountain itself. So we felt like that our investment in the region would be of value to our shareholders.
And why do you think it's important? You know, why should we be investing time and money into preserving this space?
We ourselves have hot springs called Fish River Hot Springs. And so we, through that personal experience, why many of our residents in White Mountain understand what a hot springs can do as far as healing.
But with moves forward came big changes for Pilgrim. As Unaatuq began to look into the future of the property, Louis Green Sr. and his family were asked to leave.
Yeah, that Unaatuq wanted, kept insisting it had to get out of there. And so it wasn't worth anything for me to. They just said, well, thank you for staying here, but go. I got two kids that still have camps out there. And they've been involved in some legal stuff to get them out of there. I don't know what's finally happened. They still have their cabins there.
Here, our story reaches the present day, And here we introduce our final new voice.
Name is Robert Benson. I'm the construction manager with Bering Straits Development Company. Also the division manager of the Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Division.
Bering Straits Development Company exists under Bering Straits Native Corporation, which is the acting manager for Unatuk. This means Rob plays a major role in current projects out at Pilgrim.
As one of the subsidiaries doing construction, our role is really just to do the on-site work for the grant, and my role is really just to kind of orchestrate boots-on-the-ground activities.
Unatuk has had the property since 2010, but not much has been done at the site. This summer, that looks to be changing. Thanks to a conservation innovation grant from the National Resource Conservation Service, they're taking steps to get basic agriculture underway.
The main goal this summer was, and still is to enrich the soil of 1 acre, which now we're enriching a little bit more than 1.5 acres, and then also do some improvements to the property to make it more accommodating for people to come out and enjoy the springs and the property, which the main thing for that, for the facilities, would be an outhouse. And so far, we've managed to turn over the soil, put down a cover crop, put up a small temporary fence for some test beds, and cleared the area for the outhouse, got the outhouse on site but not installed, and going to start the permanent fence that will circumference the area that will be hopefully enriched over the next couple of years.
Benson says that the soil needs to be enriched because the lack of recent agriculture has caused the fields to become overgrown with organic matter that needs to be broken down, which the group hopes to do with cover crops this summer and in the coming years if needed. And as they prepare the soil for future planting, Unatuk has other projects underway in the coming months. In addition to planting a test garden, coming up with a business plan, and completing a market study, they're focused on preserving the buildings and locating the mass grave of influenza victims that Louis Green Sr. mentioned earlier.
Well, this summer, later in the summer, there's going to be historical preservation assessment. I believe right now we're selecting, contractors to do that assessment. And we hope that we come up with a really good game plan for the preservation side of the building. Some, as many know, are probably beyond saving. But, that is a priority, is to preserve what is left out there. There is ground-penetrating radar that is scheduled for this summer as well to try and identify the location of the mass grave.
Finding this mass grave is a priority as the group continues to look at the possibility of expanding agriculture at the site in order to fulfill their long-term goal, creating a self-sufficient produce-selling operation to provide food security in the region through the native stores. According to Roy Ashenfelter, Unatuk's decision to invest in agriculture is based in part on the historical roots of growing things at Pilgrim.
So we had a meeting, and we went over photos that did an overlay of, the Unatuk or Pilgrim hot springs. And there's clearly some cleared areas that were used in the past for agriculture. So those haven't changed. There needs to be improvement on those. And so by looking at those photos, we can benefit or maximize where we would like to see agricultural start from. So that those photos help us lead to that, conclusion.
But even with this long history of successful agriculture, Rob knows that any future plans and investments will depend on the results of work over the next few years, and knows that a sustainable produce operation is still quite a ways down the road.
We know that food security is a real high priority for this region, and healthier foods. As far as what the property owners choose to invest in as far as a business opportunity, we just don't know right now.
Even with the uncertainty, Rob has high hopes for Pilgrim's future.
You know, in the long picture, yeah, an acre and a half is not going to feed the region. Other means of harvesting crops, raising and harvesting crops would have to be the long-term goal. Long-term would be on-site power generation with the possibility of, you know, a large operation of aquaponics and a resort-style destination, ecotourism. Well, the sky's really the limit out there.
But with these lofty plans come a number of doubts. Rob mentioned some difficulties with Pilgrim's soil, and Louis Green Sr. echoed them. He isn't sure that Pilgrim's fields can stand up to current agricultural plans.
The water levels are a lot higher now than there was in the 70s and 80s. And there's salt water that comes up from down below. That salt water actually comes to the surface, and you can go out there in the summertime if it's real dry and been a lot of sunshine, you find salt, cakes of salt in the moose tracks, and you can see it on the ground. So it's different. It's not like it was, you know, back then, or especially back when they had that orphanage out there.
And even if agriculture prospers, Louis thinks that the costs of shipping may also affect Pilgrim's abilities to provide produce throughout the region.
One problem you have now is the cost of growing it and getting it out of there and getting it to town or to some other villages around here is pretty high compared to what the stores can bring in through bypass mail. And when I first went out there, there was no bypass mail.
And for others like Joe Garney, the feelings of loss and anger are even greater than the sense of doubt.
Well, I'd like to see with it something productive for our region, probably. But at the same time, I don't know. I just can't hardly help but feel a loss. You know, as we had known the place to be special for us for thousands of years ends in my era. My grandchildren will never know. It's basically over at this point. I just feel lost more than anything, personally. I can't speak for everybody. I haven't gone up there in a couple of years. It just seems like the politics of the place has just soiled it, you know. Yeah, people going to court over it and putting in the newspaper to come there and get permission to go there. I've been going there for thousands of years, and all of a sudden I got to go to some office and get permission to go to a patch of earth that we felt belonged to us for thousands of years.
And while there's doubt and loss, the projects still move forward into the future. So knowing these reservations that some people have about Unatuk's plans, I asked Rob what he would say to them about the current projects.
I would say, you know, everybody, you know, that has watched over the years as nothing has happened out there other than, you know, test drilling for geothermal. You know, I'd say come out, visit, and see what we're doing. We're putting a lot of hard work into this, and I don't think that anybody that's on the project is expecting failure. This is the goal to, you know, tap the resource out there. You know, it's one of those renewable resources that just remains unused, and that's the thing is, you know, if we're gonna provide food security for the region, that's the way to do it, is to start there and then try and get agricultural projects going in all rural communities.
Matt Ganley also understands that feelings toward development at Pilgrim are complicated, but he too believes that the springs can be used for the benefit of everyone.
I just think that, Unatuk is trying to, you know, maintain the use by local folks as well as, traditional uses. people use that area for bird hunting. People in the villages of Teller and Brevik use that area for bird hunting early in the spring, and I know that's very important and vital. It's going to take time, but, you know, I hope we get some agriculture going out there and some electricity being generated as well.
In this episode, we've heard so many different stories and perspectives on Pilgrim Hot Springs. But regardless of people's opinions on Pilgrim's future, everyone I spoke to had one idea in common: the belief that Pilgrim Hot Springs is an incredibly important place in our region. For some, it was important because of subsistence, while for others, it was due to the healing properties of the springs. For others, the springs are important for their agricultural or geothermal potential, and still for others, because of their connection to family who lived or visited this place. For Matt Ganley, Pilgrim's history is the most important thing.
I think the single most important thing about the Hot Springs is its history and its connection to families in the region. There were dozens of orphans that were raised there after the 1918 flu, so many, many families in the region can trace some of their family history back there. That's critical. And the place that played, you know, at the time of the flu, when communities were devastated, there's some communities that were small villages that were essentially wiped out on the Seward Peninsula. Mary's Igloo itself lost about half its population. Nome lost 189 people out of, I don't know, maybe 200 or 300. Wales lost almost half of their population. So, you know, a lot of the kids wound up, for better or worse, being raised by the Jesuits at the mission there. And, you know, so it really is, in that respect, you know, a really, really important place in the region.
I'll end this piece by leaving you with a few things to think about. In Matt Ganley's words, one idea in particular stuck out to me, and that was when he said, "for better or for worse." And this thought combines with another theme that arose from my interviews, and particularly my conversation with Joe Garney: looking forward, but not without loss. In many ways, these two thoughts define Pilgrim Hot Springs. There is great loss associated with this place, but also great love and happiness. And ultimately, though history isn't always easy, it's already happened. So for better or for worse, and with an understanding of those things that have been lost, we end looking forward into a new chapter. Many thanks to Joe Garney, Matt Ganley, Gertrude Analoak, Bertha Calm, Teddy Mayak, Sister Alice, Louis Green Sr., Roy Ashenfelter, and Rob Benson for sharing their stories, and to all of you for listening to Story 49. I'm your host, Maddie Winchester, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Story 49's theme song is Star Child by Mystery Mammal. And this episode used music from the album A Better Place by Michael Stribling. In addition to interviews, this piece used a number of articles. No Place Like Home, published in the Congex Surrogate News in October of 1998. Pilgrim Springs, Not Just Another Hotspot by Anthony Dunn, published in Alaska Magazine in October of 1982. King Islander Remembers Life at Pilgrim Mission by Margaret Sigiana, published in the Bering Strait Record on April 16, 1997. Pilgrim Hot Springs, Garden Spot of the Seward Peninsula by Kristen Kelly, published in the Nome Nugget. Chapter 5, The Mission at Pilgrim Hot Springs and the Influenza Epidemic, 1918, from the book Pioneer Missionary to the Bering Strait Eskimos by Louis L. Renner, S.J., published January 1, 1979. Pilgrim Hot Springs, Building a Future on the Past by Patty Walter, published in the Alaskan Shepherd in March 2009. A cover story by Deborah McKinney, published in the Anchorage Daily News on April 22, 2001. Pilgrim Progresses by Maureen Sullivan, published in the Nome Nugget on July 26, 1990. Pilgrim Hot Springs, Potential Source of Power by Aaron Lilly, published in the Nome Nugget on August 15, 1996. And the nomination form for the National Register of Historic Places inventory, prepared by Michael S. Kennedy and entered on April 11, 1977. Research also came from the primary documents from the Pilgrim Springs collection of the Jesuit Oregon Province Archives at Gonzaga University, courtesy of David Kingma, to whom I am very grateful. Thank you as well to Cheryl Thompson, the UNATUC team, and my fellow KNOM staff for their support on this project. If you or someone you know has a story to share, contact KNOM at 443-5221 or via email at story49@knom.org. Story 49, sharing your story, your voice, your Alaska.